Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us from the UK, we have author Mandy Brown. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written a book called Nipples to Kneecaps. Interesting name. Well, how did you come up with a name like that, first off?
Well, the book is called Nipples to Kneecaps, To Die or Not to Die with Cancer. The nipples to kneecaps is actually reference to the fact that many years ago, when you went into hospital for a small operation, you were often shaved from your nipples to your kneecaps. And it was one of the little things that happened in the book early on that really surprised Steve. And we had a bit of a chuckle about it because he'd only had his appendix out at that point. Yeah, he was shaved nipples to kneecaps. But then it also links to the fact that later on, when we discovered that Steve was completely full of cancer, that effectively it was almost nipples to kneecaps in that way. So it's got two sort of meanings.
Yeah. Okay, let's start with you. So give some of your background before we get into the book itself.
Well, I met Steve when I was still at school. And so obviously we've been together a long time, which is brilliant. I was originally a teacher of the deaf. And Steve was originally a chef when I first met him. And then he became a sales manager. And that's sort of where we were at the beginning of the book, a very young family, very much in love. And we just had our first child. And I was on maternity leave when all of this, having had our first child, Alex, when all this started with Steve being ill. So that's just prior, before the book.
Well, let's talk about the basic premise of the story. Explain the main detail of the book to start with.
Well, when Steve was 25, as I say, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer. This was in 1986. And the way sort of it happened is, there's a little bit of a backstory to it, but generally for me, the whole story starts, and this is where it starts within the book as well, when I went to see the consultants. And bear in mind, at this point, Steve had been very ill for about a year in and out of hospital with no understanding as what's going on and why he was so ill. Anyway, I went to see the consultant, and eventually this consultant who'd just done an operation on Steve leaned over to me, and these were meant to be reassuring words. Basically, it was a bit of a one way, said, Steve has best. He has got 3 months to live. But we will help him to die as painlessly and as peacefully as possible. That's what we were told. So that was, you would think, quite a shock to me, to everyone. The Christmas before, which was Alex, our little one's first Christmas, Steve had actually said, when he was in such intense pain and spent so much time in hospital already at that point, you know, if this is cancer, I'm going to give up because it's just too painful. So I got that in the background. The other thing that happened was the consultant, as he was telling me that they'd done all the tests, they'd opened Steve up and had a look, he was full of cancer, they just sewed him back together, and just thinking, well, this is beyond hope. He was completely full of metastatic tumours, so what we call stage four. And I had had a little bit of, you may call it a premonition, but for me, it was my grandmother who had died, who'd come to me a couple of nights before and told me that Steve got cancer. So that night when I realised, so Steve was lying in hospital, if you can imagine the scenario, he'd been opened up, they'd had a look at him, they found he was full of cancer, closed him up and said, too late, it's just far too late, this young man's, you know, going to die. And I was lying in bed at night and I heard this voice saying, yes, he's definitely got cancer. And I cried my eyes out, because that night I realized here I was, a young mother with a baby, not even one, and I just cried and cried and cried. And I remember sitting up in bed after many hours and suddenly going, whoa, stop, what am I doing? Oh my gosh, I am crying for me, because I didn't want to be a mother left on her own without the person, the partner she loved. And I suddenly realised that all of this crying and tears was an absolute waste of my energy. And I literally declared to the walls, you know, OK, that is it, enough. I am not crying anymore. I will cry if and only if Steve dies. I'm going to channel that energy into something else. So I then started to formulate a plan, which was a very unusual plan. And that included things like banning my own mother from seeing Steve and his grandma, because they couldn't see Steve without crying, because he looked so ill, and indeed he was very ill. So when I did go and see the consultant a couple of days after this happening, I was a little bit prepared. I'd already got a little bit of a plan in mind. So I went along to the consultation. So when he sort of said these things to me, that, you know, this is the end, there's nothing we can do, but, you know, we'll help him to die peacefully. I was there and I said, no, and bear in mind, I was only sort of 25 myself. And I was like, no, you know, with all respect, you might be fantastic. However, I want a second opinion, and I knew exactly who I wanted. And the other thing that he did, he'd actually given me this 3 months deadline and said he's got 3 months at most. And I made a decision that day, and that was that I was not going to tell anyone else about this 3 month deadline, or death sentence as I called it. So the only people who knew was myself, Steve's parents and my parents, and everyone else was not going to know that. So a couple of days later, when I went down the ward to tell Steve that he had terminal cancer, you know, I sort of walked down the ward and Steve was very surprised to see me. And I sat on his bed and I said, okay, we finally know what's wrong with you. And I said, remember that thing called Hodgkin's? And he went, oh yeah. And I said, well, it's not that. We'd hoped it was, because at that time there was a little bit of chance of treatment. So he said, what is it? And I said, well, you've got tumours. And what are tumours? And I said, cancer. So he sort of said, oh, he said, I thought the nurses had stopped talking to me because they thought I was going to die. So I just smiled, and he didn't ask me how long he'd got, but he went very quiet once I told him that, yes, you have got cancer. And I said, but I'm going to have, immediately after I've spoken to you, Steve, I've got two people coming to see you. This was part of my plan. And they were these two people. And bear in mind, in the 1980s, finding people who survived cancer was very, very difficult. But I'd found two people who'd survived and were still alive, and they were coming in to have a chat with Steve. So that was already starting the plan going. But Steve just stood there when I told him, and he went very, very quiet. And he just said, well, I've got three things I want to do with my life. So I said, okay. And he sort of held up three fingers and said, number one, I want to grow old with you. And number two, I want to see our son grow up. And number three, and this one completely floored me, because I thought I knew Steve. He was me going, I know what Steve needs. I know what we're going to do. And he then said something which I was like, pardon, what? And he said, number three, I want to be a fencing champion. And I'm like, but you don't even fence. What? And he said, oh, well, many years ago when I was at school, a guy came in, a supply teacher, and he did fencing, and I loved it, and I'd like to be a fencing champion. I didn't know about this secret desire. I did now. So that's one of the reasons you'll see on the cover we've got some foils. So, you know, these were his three wishes, and you know, those three wishes were things that kept Steve going as well. And he did become, as you'll find out in the book, we did take up fencing. That in itself was an interesting time, taking someone who was very, very ill at fencing. But it's one of the things that we did do.
So help me understand here. So, so you find out that they're saying he's got 3 months to live. He's got cancer. They're going to help him die as comfortably as possible, and all that. But you in your mind now, you're going, well, I've got a plan. I'm going to do something. So what exactly were you thinking you were going to do with your plan? Like having people to talk to him, and the mother's not coming because of crying and all that stuff. So what was going through your mind at that moment?
Well, I think at that moment, I knew that I had to channel all of the energy that I was feeling, all of the emotion, the raw emotion, the pain, the worry, the concern, the fear of being alone, all that sort of stuff. I had to channel it into a more helpful energy, if you like. One of the things that also happened was when I was sitting on the bed with Steve that day and he said his three things. Remember I said about me not crying? Well, right. Steve, and this was one of the things about Steve and I being quite so in tune, he actually sat up in bed and he looked at me and he said, if you don't cry, I won't cry. So that was a pact we made. Okay. And then I did say, but if you're in intense pain, because at this point he was in intense pain, you know, I said, it's okay to cry if you're in intense pain. I know what he's talking about. We're not going to cry for self-pity.
Right.
For those sort of things. So that was a little pact we made about the not crying. An example of what then sort of started to happen is, if you can imagine, Steve hadn't literally got out of bed for a month or so because he was so weak. You know, he's a normally a strapping 6'2" guy. We did martial arts, we did dancing, and, you know, sort of a very fit man. And until this happened, and now I'm looking at a person in the bed who was, you know, he'd stopped getting on the scales at about 9 stone, I don't know what that is, kilograms, but he was a very frail, young, very thin young man. When I looked at him, I could already begin to see the bones through the skin. So there he is in the bed and not being able to move, hasn't got out of bed for days. And when I sort of said to him, right, we're going to have Reg come to see you and Jamie come to see you, and they're going to actually share with you their mindset, their attitude as to how and what they did. And he knew Reg, because Reg was my physiotherapist at the time, and Reg had been given he'd had stomach cancer, and he had decided mind over matter was what was going to keep him alive. Incidentally, Reg is still alive today, just as an aside. But anyway, so that was an example of the sort of person that I was going to get to see him. So at that point then, Steve said to me, okay, you know, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I've got to go now because that's not supposed to be visiting time. And Steve said, well, I'll get out of bed and walk you to the door. I'm like, well, you're going to walk me to the door. So he stood up, and the nurses came running over because he was a very ill man who could hardly stand, and he wanted to walk his wife to the door, and my dad was waiting outside. And as he sort of walked me to the door, the nurses rushed over to obviously help him, and he turned sort of back to them and sort of in Steve's jokey way, sort of said, it's okay. And they go, oh, well, Ian, it's very cold. Because then we opened the door to the hallway where the cold air from outside rushes down the corridor into the ward. And they're going, oh. And he turned around and just sort of looked at them and said, well, am I going to catch my death of cold? I thought, okay, we've got humour here. Steve has found his humour again. He's going to work with this. So humour became one of the things. So we decided that as soon as we got Steve home, that we were going to do things like we banned the TV news, for example, news programmes. We didn't watch anything that was sad or argumentative or anything in a more negative vein. We only watched comedies. We had loads of music throughout the house all the time. When people did come to visit Steve, the rule was you can come and visit Steve, but no crying, no, oh, I'm really sorry, etc. The rule was you come and you visit Steve and you tell him all about your life, what fun you were having and how fantastic life is, because that's what we want to know. We want to see life carrying on while we are sorting ourselves out. So that was another thing. But then as time went on, the plan grew and grew. But one of the things that happened was, remember I asked for the second opinion?
Right.
Well, this other doctor, there, and the reason I found this Dr. K, who came with a second opinion, was because the other gentleman that I'd found that had survived despite all the odds, this was his consultant, which is why I asked for this particular one. And Jamie said to me, you know, Dr. K will treat you, especially if you're young, up to your dying breath. So it's like, that's the one we want. And so he came to see us, and there's a scene that's sort of etched in our memories, really, of this doctor coming and standing at the end of the bed. Now, bear in mind, I've told Steve everything I know, except for the 3-month deadline. And he's standing at the end of the bed, this doctor Kitchen, and he is looking through the notes. And we are saying, OK, so Steve goes, so when can I start treatment? And he's looking through the notes. Bear in mind, the other doctor had said no treatment possible. When you looked at Steve's x-rays, the radiographers were like, they called everybody round to have a look because he was so full of tumours. They actually came and said, my gosh, you must be in incredible pain. And he was, you know, he's on loads of morphine to try and cope with the pain, but it was incredible pain because he was so full. They were really pushing and squashing all of his organs out of the way. So you can sort of understand why doctor, you know, one said we can't possibly treat, it's just too far gone. Right. So here we are with this Dr. K at the end of the bed, and he just stands there and he looks through his notes very slowly, and the time's ticking, and I'm thinking, come on, talk to us, tell us what you're going to do. And he just goes, no, there's nothing we can do. And I'm like, No, there is. And I'm thinking, what can we say to get this guy to try and at least try some treatment? And in the end, he keeps looking at the notes. And finally, he turns around and he just looks straight up at us. And he says, well, the problem is all the tumours we found, they're all secondary tumours. And back then, even from secondary tumours, unless you had the primary tumour, you couldn't work out what was the best form of treatment. But anyway, everything they found was all secondary tumours so far. And so he said, I've just no idea how we can treat this. This is just impossible. So we're looking at him and, you know, Steve was like, well, surely there's something you can do. And he just looked at Steve and went, look, you know, if the cancer doesn't kill you, the chemotherapy will. And I hear my voice going, great, thank you, we'll take it. And he looks at me and goes, I've just said, if the cancer doesn't kill you, the chemotherapy will. And I went, yes, but in that sentence, you use the word of a treatment, so let's go for it. Then he turned around, and he's very, very dour, this consultant. I mean, but he turns around, and he looks, and he says, And I said, when can I start? And he looks just at me, and he said, I can't offer anything for at least 3 months. Now bear in mind, I'm the only one in that room that knows that 3 months is all they've given Steve. So at that point, another thing goes in my head thinking, right, I will just make sure that I nag you until you do that treatment before the 3 months deadline. And that's what I did. I kept phoning up. Oh, Steve's doing really, really well. Can we start the treatment now? And he said, we can't start the treatment because Steve had been operated on and opened up. And clearly, when you, if you're trying to have chemotherapy, you can't have an open wound because then it won't heal. So there was that little dilemma to get over. But anyway, so let's sort of, we then get, go home while we're waiting for the 3 months before they'll even consider doing any sort of treatment, as he says, which will probably kill Steve anyway, but, you know, we were going. So we're home and we're thinking, well, what else can we do? And Steve started, all this was very intuitive, okay, very, very intuitive. Now, through the last 30 years, when we look back, I understand why the things we did worked, but at the time it was pure intuitive. And everybody around us, all the nurses, all the doctors, all the family and most friends, all could just believe that Steve was going to die. So it was really a world of just me and Steve saying, no, this isn't going to happen, you know. And Steve said, I'm not going to die with cancer, which is one of the reasons the title is To Die or Not to Die with Cancer. He said, I'm gonna have to die sometime, but I'm not going to die with cancer. So that's one of the reasons for that title as well. But anyway, so we were there and we decided, apart from all those other positive things, that Steve started a mantra. And the mantra was that every night before he tried to go to sleep, was he would say, tomorrow I will feel better, tomorrow I will feel better. So that was one mantra. And then we then naturally, intuitively started what we were visualizations. So Steve decided his visualizations, he picked, for some bizarre reason, he picked the Prussian army as a visualization, that there's a Prussian army inside him that were going to find all the tumors. And it was a very bloody scene that he provided, where they're going to cut the tumors up and sort them all out and all that sort of thing. Whereas mine was a more sort of gentle, maybe nursing one, where I was surrounding him a little bit like Florence Nightingale with beautiful light and healing. But we had those two things going on. But Steve would also curse at the cancer and shout at it at times. But those visualizations were something that he did. And it wasn't until a couple of months went by that we were obviously asking people for help. We weren't particularly religious or spiritual people, but anybody who said, oh, I'll pray for him, I said, yes, thank you very much, please do that. Because I believe that prayer, energy, good thoughts, etc., would all help. Was better energy coming towards Steve.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
An energy that was saying, oh, he's going to die. Oh, isn't it terrible? Isn't it awful? Because yes, it was. It was awful to see him in that state, but we couldn't afford to remain in that negative bubble. We had to be in a more positive bubble. So sort of needless to say, we got to the just before the 3 months, and I'd phoned up the consultant of the secretary of the consultant and said, Steve's really doing well. He's doing absolutely fantastic. He's really doing well. Can he start the treatment? Can he start the treatment? And literally about 1 week before the 3 months, the consultant finally said, yes, okay, you can start some treatment. So we thought, yes, that's another part of the team coming together of everybody helping. So Steve did start chemotherapy, and when he came home from his first chemotherapy, I really thought, what have I done? You know, because he now seemed, it didn't seem it was going to be possible, but he now seemed worse than he was before, because now he was throwing up everywhere. So again, we had this idea that, okay, every time you throw up, and Steve will say, and every time I go to the toilet, and every time I perspire, we would say, there goes some more of the cancer. And it became quite a little chant throughout the house that as you heard Steve throw up, there were little sick bowls all over the house. And as he threw up, wherever we were, whether it was myself, my father, my mom, Steve, or friends, we would all chime, there goes some more of the cancer. And that's what we would say. So it was that type of thing. And then, you know, little Alex, who was a real bundle of joy and energy, would want to climb on his daddy, but daddy was obviously very, very poorly. But Alex would climb on. And I remember one occasion I was in the kitchen and I could hear Alex laughing and then suddenly screeching in horror. And then I heard Steve laugh. So I go running and thinking, what on earth has happened? And Alex has jumped on top of daddy, who's had like one series of chemo, and he's found a new game, because what he's done, he's gone to pull daddy's hair and daddy's hair comes out in his hand. So Alex's new game is, oh, I can pull daddy's hair out, let's pull all daddy's hair out. And he's having a whale of a time pulling out daddy's hair. And Steve thinks it's hilarious. But, you know, it's that type of attitude that I suppose helped. And Steve and I continue to play puns and, you know, sort of puns on words and have little jokes and laugh and try and find something good in everything and funny in things. So that was another part of the plot, the plan. And then I think as time went on, as I say, they did start to give him chemotherapy. And we also had, as well as prayers and healing and things like that, we then had, we were offered something called spiritual healing. Again, we went, yeah, whatever, we don't mind it. We don't really know what it is, but yeah, come along. And this wonderful little lady came along called Doreen and her sister Dawn, and they came to the house and gave Steve this spiritual healing. Afterwards, I said to Steve, what was that like? And he said, oh, it was very relaxing. That was all I got. So I thought, oh, well, relaxing is good. Relaxing is good. That's what you need. So we started to have that. Then we get to, I think, we're at about 6.5 months now, and Steve is still alive. Woohoo! And we go to see the consultant, and I am 100% positive that the consultant is going to say, it's working, it's fantastic, it's great. But he didn't. He turned round and he completely floored us, because he went, it's not working, the tumours are getting bigger. And that was a turning point, because Steve just sort of looked at me, and I felt Steve slipping away at this point, you know, because bless him, he had fought for 6.5 months now. He'd gone past the sell by date, you know, doubled the sell by date. So I went home and I thought, what do I do? So I found Doreen and I told her the bad news, and she said, I'll come over. So she came over and I expected her to go and give healing to Steve. But she said, no, I'm going to give Steve a book. And she gave Steve a book and came down and said, I'm going to give you healing. And so she sat and she gave me healing, which I'd not really had before. And I think that really helped me. It gave me strength, because it felt like I was sort of being wrapped in love. That's the only way I can explain it. And I think for people in my situation, that are in that situation now, they have to look after themselves as well. They've got to have that little bit of help themselves too, because that really helped me. And it was just after she'd finished giving me some healing, which was then we heard Steve, and he was swearing upstairs. So I thought, what's going on? So we go upstairs, and there's Steve. And in this book that she'd given him, it had actually given the dosage of morphine that you give. It was a book about healing and cancer patients. It was a book by Harry Edwards. And it was sort of saying that when a person with terminal cancer gets to a certain stage, they have X amount of morphine, and then there's a little bit of morphine that they up it a little bit just before they pass over. Steve was already way past that dosage. Mm-hmm. And he just went, and now I do not advocate this. This is just what Steve did. He just put his book down and went, right, that's it. I am not going to take morphine any longer. He'd been on it a year trying to fight the pain. He said, I'm all fuzzy. I can't think. I'm in pain anyway. So I am stopping because I want to be able to think clearer. So we then went through withdrawal symptoms of morphine, which was fun, as you can imagine. And Steve's hallucination, you know, this being in tune with me I was talking about, Steve decided to hallucinate with the one thing that I absolutely detest. I'm sure they're beautiful little creatures, but this was maggots. He decided he'd got maggots all over his legs and would keep saying, Mandy, get the maggots off, get the maggots off. So here's me, I absolutely hate little squirrely, squiddly things, and I'm having to almost buy into his hallucination to push away these maggots that are on his legs. So it's like, oh. But anyway, he got through that. And when we did go back to see the consultant a couple of weeks later, a couple of months later, the consultant number one was visibly shocked that Steve actually walked through the door, because he thought he'd long passed and was in the earth by now. But here Steve walks in to go, hi, I'm still here. And now at that point, you know, Steve said, oh, by the way, I stopped the morphine. And he said, well, you know, the chemotherapy wasn't working. No, it wasn't. And so the doctor said, well, I might as well examine you. And he examined him. And to his credit, Dr. K, as we call him, Dr. K actually turned around and said, oh, my gosh, I have been an oncologist for many, many, many years. And I have seen very few miracles. But this is one. This is a miracle. He said, the tumours are shrinking. So whatever you are doing, just carry on doing it. So we did. And that's what we did. And we carried on. And eventually we went back and it was like, that's it. There's no more tumours. They've gone. So, you know, there were other things that obviously we did along the line. And one of them was we did every day, I suppose you'd now call it a meditation practice. Again, it was intuitive for us and partly guided by, we were told there was this thing called the healing minute, which is every night at 10 o'clock and in the morning at 10 o'clock. It still goes on now. It still happens now. Healers around the world tune in and they either send healing, energy, thoughts, love, prayers, whatever, out to be used for healing. And the people who need healing can be there and they can receive it. So we did that every day as well. And we had a little group of friends that would usually come and sit with us and we'd all sit and we'd meditate. He didn't have a clue what we were doing. We were just belief. And it was our way of, I suppose, helping Steve and doing what we can do to give that love and energy. And I do believe that. In the 30 years that have gone, I have different understandings of what was happening. So, yeah, so that was the other thing we did.
Mm-hmm. So when you wrote the book, mm-hmm. and someone takes this home and reads it now, yes. What is it you want them to get out of it? Like, what is the major point or idea that you want them to walk away with?
I think the major point is, if they are ever faced with what seems an impossible challenge, whether that is a terminal illness diagnosis or some other devastating disease or any other horrible thing that, you know, sort of has happened to them, which seems an impossible situation, and they feel they're never going to get out of it, or they won't have the strength or ability to get out of it. I hope that they can remember Steve's story and draw on our strength that we had within that book, and draw on what we did, and realise that if it's possible for one person, Steve, it is possible for them. So that I want it to be a book of hope and inspiration that a person can, as I say, draw on and remember the story. Over the years, we've told the story to so many people, family, friends, people we've met. And time and time again, it has been lovely because people have come back and they've said, you know, you told me Steve's story. Yes. And they will say, my sister had cancer, or I have cancer, and I remembered Steve's story, and it helped me be positive. It helped me take back control of my body. Because I think sometimes what can happen is when you're given a terminal diagnosis, it's almost sometimes that people feel like they've got no control left, but you have. You've got control over what happens to you. That is not to say, Steve and I have since then, we've worked with cancer patients almost all our life now. So obviously in that time, we have seen many, many people, despite the odds, survive and live full and healthy lives. But equally, we've seen people who it was their time, and they have died, they've passed on. My own father, my uncle, included in that. But what I can say, when we've worked with them in the way that we work, that their passing has been one of peace and readiness. That's the only way I can say it. But Steve clearly wasn't ready, and all I can say that we share Steve's story and know that it has in the past given people inspiration to fight their own battles, whatever those battles are. That's what my hope is, that it will help them, give them that confidence to take power of what happens in their life, and to maybe stand up sometimes and say, no, actually, I'm going to do this, or I want to do this.
So do you think the strongest thing that you used to fight his cancer was your more your inspiration, more your what you had, more than anything that the doctors could do?
I like to say that it was a team effort. I know when we had a surprise party for Steve at the very end, you know, once he was all clear, and we invited everybody, all our friends who'd supported us, all our family, but we also invited all the nurses and the doctors and the physios and everyone. And I feel that it's almost a holistic thing. We worked together. However, I would say, and I know I've asked Steve many times, you know, what he thinks it was. And he would say it was now we use the word mindset, but at the time we used our intuition and our belief. It was our belief in each other that even though everybody around us believed that Steve was going to die, and I understand why, but we had a knowing, and we just went, no, there's a lesson here for us. There's something we need to do. Let's work on this. And we kept that positivity. So for us, I suppose it was understanding. There's another aspect of this, is that I also believe from a very young child that we are eternal. And that is something that I have a knowing about, and I can't really explain too much in this interview, but it is a knowing that we are eternal beings, and that there is something within that that also I was able to draw on and use. But yeah, Steve would say that it changed anything, and he laughs and says, yeah, the pain. But apart from the pain, he said, no, I wouldn't have changed it. And that's really odd for someone to hear, you know, who would willingly say, oh yeah, I have cancer. Ew, what? But what he said was, the reason that, you know, he wouldn't change it is because we learned such a lot. We learned a lot about ourselves. And in one way, we were very blessed, because all of the other things that were going on with life were taken away, and we were able to concentrate on what was important. And that was love, in a way. And family and be in that unit. And in one way, we really value that time that we had, that very special time we had, which I would call that almost soul to soul time. That's very important. And that's what I mean about being eternal. It gave us that lesson of learning. We learned a lot of things, and it did change our lives. It did change Steve to a certain extent. You know, he's never suffered fools gladly, he would say. But also we will, you know, what we then went on to teach our children about believe in yourself and everything is possible. You know, a life lived in fear is a life half lived. Things like that. So it's about then going on and really enjoying and embracing life. Life is meant to be fun. And I think we knew that even when Steve was going through the worst of the cancer and, you know, things were happening to him. But we just knew that life was meant to be fun and we could get through it. So, yeah.
So now where can people find out about you, the story, and more about the book?
Well, the book is on Amazon, and obviously it's called Nipples to Kneecaps, To Die or Not to Die with Cancer by Mandy Brown. So you can buy the book on Amazon. You can also go to my website, which is www.nippletonkneecaps.com or mandybrown.co.uk. But at the moment, it still goes to nippletonkneecaps.com. You can also find us on Facebook. Again, this Mandy Brown author is my Facebook page. I've also got a YouTube channel, Mandy Brown author as well, YouTube. And I've got quite lots of little clips that I've put on YouTube, like 2 minutes long, of why we've written it, what we think about healing, little snippets of reading out of the book. And the questions that people ask me, I've sort of tried to do the answers then in the little videos as well on the video channel.
Fantastic. We'll have that on our website as well. So people listening can just find you in one click. Has everything been okay with the COVID for you? And are you worried about that being, especially Steve being through cancer?
Well, no. I mean, Steve actually works in hospitals. He works in about 8 hospitals. So he has throughout the whole of COVID been going in and out to all the different hospitals. And so, no, we've been fine. Our daughter also works in the hospitals. We obviously take the precautions that we need to do. We're sensible and we're following all the guidance and guidelines, but generally, you know, we are keeping healthy. Thank you.
And what's coming up next for you?
Well, I've got a couple of books in pipeline. I've got one that is called The Astral Projection Handbook, 101 Techniques for out of body and astral travel, in a very handy A to Z format. So that's the Astral Projection Handbook. The other book I've got is a book on healing, about the keys to healing. Because what we found is when we've been working with healers of whichever modality, sometimes the healers get ill. And also we found with patients, they're saying, I'm doing absolutely everything that I'm supposed to do. I still get ill. What is going on? So I've been looking into that and answering those questions. And that's one of the other books. The Keys to Healing book is aimed at healers, practitioners, and also aimed at people who are doing all the right things, but they need a little bit more guidance and help. And then the third big book, which is a long booking process. One of our children is deaf, blind and autistic, and often when he was growing up, people would ask us, well, how do you communicate with a deaf, blind child, or deaf, blind, what do you do? And through his life, we have had a lot of challenges, and not all of those challenges have come from the disability. They've actually come from people's perceptions around him, and also the system. We've had to fight the system, you know, to get the correct education. There were times when he ended up with no school because there couldn't be a school that was found, and he had to be home educated. There were times when, as he became an adult and he wanted to be this independent young man, we were always told he would never be able to talk, but we were determined he might not be able to speak, but he would certainly be able to communicate. and communicate he can, which is wonderful. But as he then became a young adult who wanted to be semi-independent, he ended up in supported living, and unfortunately, on more than one occasion, he suffered abuse at the hand of carers. And, you know, there was one day when he came home and he just sort of signed and said to me, "Mom, I want it to stop." And I'm like, "What to stop?" And he goes, and he's very sort of innocent in the way he said, he explained it to me. He said, "Oh, I'm being thrown against the wall, and I'm really scared, and I don't like it anymore. And they keep ripping my jumpers, but it's okay, Mom. They buy me new ones. It's fine." And we were like, "What's going on here?" So, you know, it was, that was part of the journey. But then a lot of things have happened to him, and I wanted to help other parents and families who have a child with, you know, a child that's slightly different needs, and that are fighting the system and fighting other people's opinions and views and discrimination and all that sort of stuff. But again, we did it in a very positive way. So that's another book, and that's He Will Never Talk is another one. But that's taken me a long time to write, because it gets quite emotional with some of the ups and downs, you know, the abuse and things that happened to him.
Well, that's amazing. This is great. So, again, we'll have everything up on the website. We really appreciate you coming in and talking about your book. Our guest has been Mandy Brown. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.